Welcome to the Next Regeneration Podcast by the Osteology Foundation. We feature hot topics and novel perspectives, always with relevance to the dental career and practice. Join our hosts, Anina and Elena, as they speak with new guests from around the world each month and learn more about what's important for the next generation in oral regeneration.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to our podcast. Today, we are going to discuss a very important topic, especially for the younger generation. We are talking about how to decide between a more academic career and a more private practice-oriented career pathway. Obviously, this is a very important decision in our lives as dentists because it will shape our future professional lives. So we have to choose wisely and also consider all the pros and cons. And that's why we decided to do two podcast episodes on this topic, one more focused on academia and one more focused on private practice. Right, Elena?
Yeah, exactly, Anina. So the dilemma between academia and private practice is something that many of us has faced during our professional life. And obviously, there is no right answer or wrong answer on what is better, but both are viable options and present some advantages and disadvantages that we will try to discuss and explore with our guests. Today, we are extremely privileged to have with us Professor Purnima Kumar, that will obviously discuss about the beauty of academia and why she chose to pursue this pathway. Purnima is a professor of dentistry and chair of the Department of Periodontology and Oral Medicine at University of Michigan School of Dentistry. She received her dental degree from Annamalai University in India and her master's degree in periodontology and PhD in molecular microbiology from Ohio State University, where she previously served also as professor of periodontology and chair of the oral biology PhD program. So welcome, Purnima. It's really a huge pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be talking to two rising stars in periodontal academia.
Thank you, dear Purnima. Also from my side, hello to our podcast. And what an honor to have you here today, especially when I look at your career. Your pathway in academia is very impressive, and you reached positions of leadership in the U.S., first in Ohio State University and now in the University of Michigan. I must say, you are really an inspiration for many of us. Did you have clear ideas about following an academia pathway from the very beginning? Because if I'm not sure or not wrong, you were working in private practice in the beginning and then you switched to academia. So what were your reasons for returning to university?
Yes, that's right. So you know, my life is a rolling stone, truly a rolling stone, right? I tell people I'm like the sun. I rose in the east and I'm setting in the west. So I started life in private practice. And so in India, you're allowed to do both private practice and have a career in academia, mostly as a teaching position rather than a research intensive position. So I was doing that and had a private practice right after I finished down school. Then we moved to the Middle East, where I was working for the federal ministry. And then we came to the United States after spending a few months, not a long time, but a few months in England as well. And so my academic journey in all dimensions has been over three countries and two continents. And you know, I did start life in private practice, and I loved the clinical. To me, the clinical aspect of periodontics, the surgical aspects especially, were extremely, I loved it. I absolutely continue to love it, but that's what drew me to perio. And so the thought of going in there, doing surgeries, being able to change one patient a day, every day, change lives one patient at a time, or even one PDL at a time sometimes, was truly very, very important to me. After some years in private practice, while I was still, you know, in a academic adjunct academic position, so to speak, I started finding myself to be more curious about things. Why is this happening to my patient? Why am I being more successful in one patient therapy than in the, if I do the same treatment on another patient? And as you look in the literature, you find that there are not so many answers there. So I started getting more and more attracted to the research elements of asking your own questions and being able to answer why. To do that, I realized I had to be trained in research. Research is not simply something that you just jump in and start doing one day. You actually have to be trained in research methodology, and you have to make a decision on whether you want to stay in a clinical research, which is more outcome-based, you know, examining pre- and post-surgical, pre- and post-therapeutic interventions, those kinds of population-based, epidemiological, outcome-based studies, or if you want to examine the mechanisms that underlie disease, which means you have to get more training in the molecular and the cellular aspects of the disease. And I chose to go into more the basic biology side of it because I always want to get to the root of the matter, pun intended. So I wanted to do that. And so I went back and got a PhD. And that was it. That was it. After that, you know, this is what brings me to work every day. I feel like I'm Einstein. I come in every day. I discover something new. You know, I'm not just transmitting. I don't want to say just transmitting. I'm transmitting knowledge that I have gained, but I'm also creating knowledge. And to me, that is the most important aspect of what I do every day.
Yeah, very stimulating also. I mean, there is something new every day, as you said, to discover
exactly.
And to implement.
There's no time to get bored. There is no time to get bored. And you know what? Academia provides this very unique opportunity. You're always with people who are 22 to 30 years old, and that's your age. You cannot grow old because you're constantly, you know, we can grow old, but your resident is always 25 years old. So it's hard to age yourself when you're constantly dealing with a population that never ages.
Yeah, we keep young in research. I like this message, actually. But Purina, I mean, do you recall any turning point in your career, like specific episodes or moments that ended up being really key for the choices you made in your professional life? I don't know if there is, a specific episode that you want to tell us.
It's not an episode. It's more, you know, a person or people. Mm. You know, I was influenced largely by people and circumstances that I found in. You know, I was trained by people who were very, very strong clinicians. When I was in India, we evaluated our value as how well we can cut gums and how well we can reflect a flap. And, you know, that was the metric by which you're. So these were strong clinicians who were completely committed to treating periodontal disease in the best way they knew possible and to teaching you the best techniques so that one-on-one, I have had professors who would stand all 3 hours over me, with me during every step of the way. They actually would hold the suction and assist me. That's how I was, you know, that one-on-one didactic preceptorship, you know, the artisan kind of a work. So that value that they transmitted to me drove me to start a career in clinical periodontics first. And then when I came to the Middle East and, you know, the world started opening up some more and I had opportunities to listen to, you know, that was when we were actually having these kind of workshops and meetings and general meetings and all of these things. And seminars and they were all still in person, but we got the opportunity to explore what was outside, what the people I'd read about in textbook. I remember Dr. Melamed, the guy who wrote our anesthesia textbook, came to give a talk in Dubai. And oh my God, it was such a fangirl moment. It was like I had forgotten everything I'd learned about and, you know, how to give a local anesthetic. And I was just sitting there listening to him. How should you do this and how you should not push the needle, but pull the flap towards you so the, you know, the patient doesn't feel the needle pressure. It's about forcing the tissue into the needle rather than forcing the needle into the tissue. It was like my whole world was opening again. And I was like, this is what I want to do. This is truly what I want to do. I want to be at the cutting edge of knowing how to do things and how to innovate in that method. And you know, so to me, that became important. So again, that was an inspiring moment. And that was an inspiring situation where I said, it's not enough to do something. It is important to know how to do it better and how to innovate. So innovation became key. And then I came to the United States, and my PhD mentors, it's very funny, they're a husband-wife team. Everything in my life is by twos. We have twin daughters, you know, everything is twos, right? So I had to have two PhD mentors, not one. And their husband-wife, the husband's a basic biologist. The wife is a pediatric dentist who's extremely interested in studying aggressive, what we formerly called aggressive periodontitis. But now we know as a molar incisor stage C. So she was extremely interested in understanding the microbiological aspects of it. And so to me, understanding the etiology and pathogenesis of disease and going deeper than how to get better outcomes of treatment became more important. So I'd rather say my life was shaped more by people rather than by pivotal incidents.
Yeah, see this. I mean, the key, as you said, there are persons, and it makes absolutely sense. And also, I wanted to ask you the same question, like how important are mentors? And you already said it. It's a key, right?
Yeah, it is. Mentors make or break a person, right? They can either make you absolutely enthusiastic and curious. So I, one thing I have learned and I have experienced, I'm sure you two also have seen this, is that, you know, the one thing that keeps us young is being curious. If you accept that every time you get a result, it only opens up 100 more questions. It doesn't answer. It maybe answers, maybe, if you're really lucky, one question, but it actually opens up 100 more questions for us to explore. This is what we're finding out, right? You two know that. Yes. We're all talking the same language here. So when we have that kind of a, you know, that is what keeps us young, that curiosity. And if a mentor is what makes a person a curious learner or someone who decides, I've had enough, I'm done, I did what I came to do, and I'm moving on. So mentoring, either through, you know, and we call them different names. We call them mentors. Some people call them life coaches. And me, the same person, I'm an instructor some days. Some days I'm a mentor. And some days I'm a life coach. You know, there's a table sitting right next to me, which is what I'm pointing to here. And that's what I'm doing. I'm sitting there. We're talking about things that have nothing to do with perio, nothing to do with academia, really how to balance that thing called life and fit that into this thing called work, and how to balance the two and develop a sense of happiness around it. And on some days I'm an influencer. I'm literally posting on Facebook or Instagram or Reddit. I'm an influencer. So that same person takes on multiple different roles, but bringing positivity to whatever you're passionate about is truly what makes you a mentor. You don't become a mentor. People see you as a mentor, right? So to me, that is an important distinction. I don't say I'm going to mentor someone. Someone says, I want you to mentor me. And so it's an honor and a privilege to take on that role. And mentors are everything. I owe everything in my life to the mentors I have found. And these are not people who said, I'm going to mentor you. These are people I consider my mentors.
Yeah. It's like more what they are actually doing. And also, as you said, it's the support of everything. Like, it's not starting at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning and ends at 5. Sometimes you have also other influences from outside, which actually then also affects your work. And sometimes you have to deal with that as well, because they're not concentrated anymore. And sometimes you just need someone. And absolutely. That could be then your mentor. Yes.
It could be. Who knows you better than your mentor? They
exactly.
Know, at least one aspect of your life they know really well. The work aspect of your life they know. So they know how you perform there, and they can take that information and help you, you know, finagle the other parts of your life as well, right? So mentoring is critical. And I think the access to mentors is great within academia, because we're all somehow built in. It's in our DNA to mentor and to be mentored and have that kind of a relationship. So that is another very rewarding aspect of being in academia. As a private practitioner, I used to have to go and seek out mentors. I had to go to a meeting. I had to listen to an influencer. I had to go out and seek that. Here, I think I have more access, and I am more accessible as a mentor. So that to me is a big plus of being in academia.
Yeah, I can see that. But so obviously we just discussed the beauty of academia, all the different aspects, how it keeps us young, stimulated. But obviously there are challenges as well, like in every aspect of life. So in general, what are the most critical aspects when following the academic pathway? Because obviously you mentioned that already. Sometimes it's not just one job, it's multiple jobs at the same time, because you teach, you do research, you see patients in the clinic, you try to inspire new generations, you try to also, you know, sometimes like in your position, you will have to deal with a team, so putting together people, managing people. So what is the recipe really to find a good balance and face these challenges?
So I have one word in which I'm going to put all of it together. It's called compartmentalization. So you have to learn to, one of the primary skills of being successful in academia for me has been compartmentalizing. You know, when I went to my PhD, I told you my two mentors, one was a clinician, one was a scientist, pure scientist, right? And they would both laugh at me. My mornings would start with, I used to start my experiments. We did a lot of cloning and sequencing when I was a grad student. So, you know, you have to do PCR and you have to clone and you have to do, there's a process. It's do something, wait 2 hours, do something, wait 2 hours. So I would start at 4:30 in the morning, set up my PCR experiments, 8 o'clock, go to clinic, see patients, do surgery, 11 o'clock, come back, finished experiment. I'd start at 4 in the morning. So, you know, people would laugh at me. They'd be like, if I see her flying by in that white coat, I know that she's headed to the lab to finish her experiment. So my two mentors found it very funny that I was able to switch off my clinical brain and switch on my research brain that way. And that was a great opportunity to learn how to actually start putting things into compartment and taking them out and using them, prioritizing them and learning. And you know, you have to be a very curious thinker as a researcher, but as a clinician, you have to believe and be faith-based and say, whatever I do is going to work, and not question that, because your patient's healing depends on your faith. So there are multiple different ways in which your brain is going to keep changing, right? So compartmentalizing is critical, and being able to give and prioritizing, and being able to prioritize, because everything needs to be done, but not everything needs to be done at this moment in the same time. So certainly setting priorities is going to be very important. So academia is not for everyone. It's definitely for that. But more than that, what I hear about academia, and I really want to talk about this really quickly for a second or two, is that academia pays very little when compared to private practice. And that is the biggest reason why most people don't, you know, try to move away from academia into private practice. There's actually, if you look at the dental economics of academia, it takes being, if you're in academia for 17 years versus in private practice for 17 years, you actually, after year 17, academia pays you more than private practice. It truly is. And they've looked at it based on countries. Yes, this is a fact. This is not interesting opinion. This is a fact. So after being 17 years in academia, you actually start making more money because of the benefits and the retirements and the insurance plans and all the other aspects and the safety networks that are provided to you. So if you just look at the numbers, just finances of it, forget everything else, just numbers in terms of salary figures and everything else, there is a benefit to being in academia. And that's, yes, it's not short term. It's, you know, you have to stay the course, but staying the course definitely has a benefit. I mean, even in a private practice, you're not going to retire, you know, after 5 years in private practice, nobody is planning that. So staying the course long term, there are long term benefits to that. But again, having said that, I will say academia is not for everyone. It, like you correctly said, Elena, it comes with a lot of different challenges. And for me, the easiest way of you know, taking care of those challenges is by prioritizing and compartmentalizing, putting things into boxes, picking what box I'm going to handle today at this moment in time is critical to that. Also, the other thing to important to remember is that academia is more about teamwork, and it's more mission and goal oriented, and it's, you know, you are finally serving the strategic mission of a university, of a school, of a college, of a department. And we need to have that buy-in. You need to be very sure that you're completely in sync, and you relate to the strategic mission or this one, because then otherwise you're conflicted. And either you express your conflict, you know, to an audience that is not ready to hear that conflict, or in your own head, you're conflicted and that adds to your personal stress. You're like, I don't like what they're saying. I don't agree with what they're saying, but I'm going to have to do this because the school or the college or the department or my chair said so, right? So you have to be able to have that ability to think it through and say, I will pick a position or a place that is in sync with my own strategic mission and my goals and my value system. So that match is a little more important in academia because it's a very large institution and a very small person. Otherwise, one can swallow the other. So I think of that as something being important as well.
And also when I listen to you, it seems like you are so good organized and you are like a superwoman. You can do everything and you have right. And Elena and I, we are doing probably a long-term investment and hopefully at some point
it'll pay back. Off. Hopefully.
Yes, I hope so. But Elena, we have a refuge, let's say.
Yes.
You're on the absolute right track. You're on a smooth glide path to success. I see this as no other way. You're creating knowledge, you're disseminating knowledge, you're influencing people, you're mentoring people, you're instructing people. What else is required in life? You're still, I mean, you're in clinical practice as well. Like me, I still see patients. I see patients on Wednesdays. So to me, that's an important aspect of what I do because every question, every research question for me comes from my patients. And I love surgery. I love surgery. So you're treating patients. So you're making a difference in so many aspects. How can you two not be the future, you know, yeah, successes, stars of our profession? You are what our profession hopes to be, but is not.
Exactly. No, and then, but I also think, are there any qualities you must have to be successful? Can you say that? I mean, do you have like some words or names or terms which you think, okay, this you need to have to be successful? Or do you have any tips what a young researcher should and should not do in order to be successful in this field?
So I can tell you what I have done, and that and $2 will buy you coffee anywhere. So to me, you know, I am completely open to collaboration. For me, for me, you know, diversity of thought is what is my dearest quality. I believe that the more I talk to people, the more I engage with people, the more ideas come and the more opportunities to look at things from a different perspective, a different light. I mean, the same data set, I can look at it three different ways or four different ways, depending on how many people I'm talking to. And so constantly having constant conversation and having that openness and that willingness to hear other perspectives is, you know, sometimes we're so close to our research and our data. We get to be very possessive about it. Like, how can you say I'm wrong? Why is this wrong? No, I am right. I know my data. But then when you think of it, hey, they're looking at it from a completely different lens. It's not, nobody's saying your data is wrong. They're looking at it from a different lens. And when you look at it from that perspective, this might, what might come out of the data. And so then you start getting a more 360 view of your research and your data. And that is very important. That perspective is important. And when you start doing that, you say, hey, I am not the only one who can answer this question. I need this person and this person and this person and this person with this expert and this expertise and this expertise to be come in together. And you start building teams. And once you start building teams, I think this, you know, it automatically sets you on a path to success because now, you know, success is shared, ideas are shared. If things go wrong, they're also shared. But mostly, you know, when things go right, they're shared. And then again, that whole concept of building teams, being collaborative and being completely open. So curiosity, right? Like, okay, this is what I think my data means. But if you look at it, what do you think it means?
Yeah.
Right?
That's very, very true. Yes. Absolutely.
And we get very possessive. I remember being young and possessive and saying, I found this and it has to be the right way and there's no other change about it. But
yeah, questioning always your data yourself, I think it really helps in research. Absolutely. So Purnina, before concluding, I just wanted to briefly ask you another question. So touch very briefly another topic, let's say, because you serve on several task forces for women in science, women in surgery and women in STEM. And also you volunteer for groups that empower women locally and nationally. So how difficult still is for women to reach leadership positions in academia? Have you seen, for instance, any change in comparison to, I don't know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago?
I'm going to start by answering your second question first. Yes, there is a change. There's definitely a change. I was 2 years ago, I attended a leadership institute for women in academic medicine. And it's a very well-known leadership institute. And the founding president of the leadership institute, she came to talk to us, Dr. Moynihan. And she said, you know, I am very sad today. I'm not happy to welcome you to this class. I'm very sad. And we looked at her like, goodness, now what? And she said, because 25 years after I started this institute, there is still a need for this institute here, right? That women have to be trained. So we have certainly not made as many strides as we could have, should have, would have. We didn't. But women are recognizing, and so are men, and so is society at large recognizing that women add a very significant value to a leadership role. And truly, it is the difference of being a woman that brings that level of leadership quality. So you don't have to be like a man to be a leader. It is the very qualities that differentiate between women and men that bring a very specific element of leadership to women in leadership. So recognizing that the differences between how men and women process information, process interactions, process everything, team building, any quality, strategic thinking, any quality that you think is important to leadership, how women and men differ in how they do those things are what adds value to any leadership role. Is definitely being more obvious, is definitely being more recognized. Is our work here done? Not even. I always tell people, if you're not at the table, you will be on the menu. So women have to continue being on the table, because there are certain perspectives that only women get and women understand, and women are intuitively adapted to say yes to, just like there are men. And so it's good to be represented by people who look, feel, and think like you. And therefore, having women in leadership is critical. Plus, you need role models. Other women need role models to look up to and say, that is what I see and that is what I want to be. And so we need that.
Yes, absolutely. That's true. So, dear Punia, we talked about so many things, and it was so interesting, and it was a pleasure to have you as a guest on our podcast. It was really nice that you took the time to talk to us about your career pathway, which is so interesting. And it's also very helpful and inspiring to hear the story, what you have and what you achieved. And thank you very much for everything. It was really nice.
Thank you. It was such a huge honor to be invited to this, and the Osteology Foundation and the two of you, our shining rising stars. So I'm going to watch your stars with very, very close interest, and I'm going to watch them rise. So good luck, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you also from my side, Purnina. Really a huge pleasure having you here. And I'm really confident that your passion for academia, for research, will be of inspiration for all the people like us that are going to hear the podcast. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the Next Regeneration Podcast by the Osteology Foundation. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. This helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.